the studios of KPCW in Park City, this is Cool Science Radio. It's science and technology that's accessible and entertaining, and if we can understand it, so will you. I'm Lynn Ware-Peak.
And I'm Katie Mullally. Well, first this morning, we talk with writer Richard Simon about his year of going smartphone-free in his book, Unplug, How to Break Up with Your Phone and Reclaim Your Life.
Then Professor Paul Brooks from the University of Utah's Geology and Geophysics Department joins us to talk about the long journey snowmelt takes as groundwater before it leaves the mountains. Stay tuned for these guests this hour on Cool Science Radio. We'll be back.
Welcome back to Cool Science Radio. I'm Katie Mullally.
And I'm Lynn Ware-Peak.
Have you ever fantasized about breaking up with your smartphone, of having all that time back for your life that has been spent mindlessly scrolling or compulsively checking for new alerts? Or is the thought of being without your smartphone more of a nightmare, where you wouldn't know how to function without the easy access to social media, emails, and Google? For our next guest, he went all in to discover what would happen without his smartphone for a whole year. Author Richard Simon shares his story of digital detox in his new book, Unplug, How to Break Up with Your Phone and Reclaim Your Life. Richard also shows us how we too can cut back or maybe even eliminate our addiction to our smartphones. Richard, welcome to Cool Science Radio.
Katie, Lynn, thank you so much for having me. It's really great to be on.
Okay, so how bad is our addiction really?
Yeah, unfortunately, it's bad. The average American adult at this point spends more than 5 hours a day on a smartphone. Add that up over the course of an entire year, that's more than 75 full days. And for teens, it's even worse in terms of time on phones. I mean, teens spend more than half their waking hours on a smartphone. And you can sort of laugh it off and say it's crazy, but you know, once you start getting older, like we as adults are, we realize that our time on this earth, it's a finite, non-renewable resource, and we are losing out in terms of time. So yeah, it's a real problem.
What else are we losing out on besides just time? Because I've read other things about how staring at a small screen all day is bad for our eyesight, it's bad for our mental state. Again, other than time, how else is all of this smartphone addiction affecting us?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, yeah, it's not just quantitative. I mean, it's very much qualitative in terms of sleep, in terms of exercise, mental health. I mean, there have certainly been moral panics before about various forms of technology, whether it be the television, the radio, even comic books. But what makes this so scary is that this is really the first time in human history where we've never been able to really experience solitude the way that previous generations have. This constant companion model in terms of the phone, where you just always have it on you, you're always carrying it. Any moment of silence, whether you're waiting at the grocery store or even if you're having a really, really important conversation, let's say with a loved one, like a spouse, a child, a parent, and it's in your pocket, it has an impact. So this moment feels very different. It's impacting so many facets of our lives.
If you're just joining us on Cool Science Radio, we're speaking with author Richard Simon. He's written a new book called Unplug, How to Break Up with Your Phone and Reclaim Your Life. Okay, Richard, it's not as though you are a Luddite or anything like that. You are, in fact, the director of website strategy at Georgetown Law in Washington, D.C., and you've spent a lot of time in technology. So we can call you an authority on the subject. How about that? I am wondering, have you been able to ascertain what sections of phone use are we spending the most amount of time in? And, you know, like, for example, how much time do we spend looking at our photos? Because I've often thought, what if I just went back to the old-fashioned camera? Then how much of that iPhone use time would be taken away?
Sure. Yeah, so it really varies by individual, but some of the big ones in terms of phone use, certainly not surprising. Social media and social media apps, certainly in terms of mobile gaming and gaming on phones, things like Safari, and if you're on an iPhone or if you're on a Samsung internet browser, is a big one. Music streaming and video streaming, and then even just the core function, which is what the original mobile phone was for. It was for making calls. There are so many facets of the phone which serve as a distraction. So even though, for example, so much of the focus of smartphone overuse is on social media, you know, even if you take social media away, it still doesn't take away from just how addictive of a device it is. Like I mentioned, just even a handful of them. What's so addictive about the phone isn't just the amalgamation of just so many different tools, but also the portability. So the fact that you can take the internet, you can take your phone, you can take a music player, a video player, a social media connection device, and it can follow you everywhere you go, from your bedroom to the baseball field, to the soccer game, your kid's soccer game. So there are many facets of the phone that are problematic.
Yeah. So what was that trigger for you that made you decide to, or what was sort of the mounting use and the series of decisions that you made to lead you to a digital detox, which you share in your book?
Yeah, I always had a problem with my phone, even in college. I went to a school called Goucher College. It's a liberal arts school just outside Baltimore. I started school in 2004. So this is 3 years before the smartphone came out. I remember getting my first cell phone. And I just remember, even in the dining hall, like we were all hooked on them. And there's a fantastic book. It was released in 2006, very academic. And the book was called Cell Phone Culture. This is a year before the smartphone came out. And I was talking about anxieties that teens had in terms of doing too much texting, how it was impacting interpersonal relationships. And like, I even saw and felt it when I was in college, just how much of a distraction it was. Now, you fast forward slightly to when the first iPhone came out in 2007, and then just things really started to get out of control in terms of my use and so many, you know, other people. But it really wasn't until 2016, where me and my wife, we had our first kid. And when we had our first child, that's where it was a really, really big wake-up call for me in terms of how much I was using it. You know, I would be changing a diaper and I'd feel a ping in my pocket and I'd be thinking about it and then be at the zoo and I should be enjoying this moment with our son. And instead, I'm just looking at my phone, looking at email, looking at whatever might be coming across. And then we had our second child in 2019 and I just felt like enough was enough. It was impacting so many parts of my life, from my work and being able to focus in terms of my relationship with my wife. I mean, we'd be texting each other throughout the workday. She's a pediatrician, I'm in technology. And by the time we got home in the evening, there was nothing to catch up on. We were texting throughout the day. My relationships were suffering. I was texting for the most part with my dearest friends, you know, every single day instead of actually having real conversations. Maybe most of all, like, it's a bit selfish, but I wasn't spending enough time investing in myself. So that's what really started this idea of, all right, what can I do about it? So I tried a lot of different hacks that most of us are trying and what most self-help books and articles are espousing are these like shortcuts. But none of them got me closer to my goal of being in control of my phone rather than it being in control of me. And that's why I made the decision that I was going to turn my smartphone off for an entire year.
I love in your book, you're talking about when you first went smartphone free, you're standing in line at the grocery store and everyone else has their phones out and you're standing there going, okay, what do I do? And it seemed like there was almost a moment of panic before you went, oh, wait, my brain can kick in for all the daydreaming. And I love to go to, if I'm in a doctor's office or somewhere, I will leave my phone in my pocket because one, it's kind of fun because it makes everybody else a little uncomfortable, I think, because they look at you like, why aren't you on your phone? But you also get that moment to just daydream and think and process problems. So when you first broke up, how did you overcome this addiction?
Yeah, I definitely went through withdrawal. And that piece you spoke about is certainly true. I remember we were on vacation in South Carolina, Isle of Palms, I'm in the Harris Teeter store, and literally I'm just waiting in line. It's the first day of my detox, January 1, 2020. And I'm freaking out inside. I'm like, only three people in front of me in line. It's a night, the grocery store is only one person, you know, who's waiting for people. So there's a bit of a line. And like, I'm looking at the expiration dates, trying to figure out something to do for the food, or to make sure everything checks out in terms of expiration dates. I'm looking at the tabloids, something's interesting me. And I'm like, oh my gosh, like I actually have to like be comfortable in my own skin. And that's like a crazy, crazy thing to think about because, I mean, We've never had to do like this before in the history of civilization, in terms of being comfortable enough in our own skin to have to like be comfortable with silence. What I found as I reached out to dozens of other people who had similar resets in terms of turning off their phones is that withdrawal is completely natural when it comes to turning off something as addictive as a smartphone. Now, for some people like me, it can be, you have a lot of anxiety, like really nervous those first few weeks because it's very uneasy when you have something you're spending hours a day on and all of a sudden you haven't, you don't have something to fill that time. But after you get past the first 2 or 3 weeks, this goes across all of the various people that I profiled as well as my own story, is that then you start to realize, okay, like I can make this work. And all of a sudden you realize I have time and I can fill it with meaningful things. But yeah, the first few weeks were certainly challenging in terms of getting used to that.
Well, I know that a number of listeners, and ourselves included, were able to enjoy life pre-smartphone. So we know what it was to not have a phone, but yet here we are all addicted. And you talk about how the traditional hacks haven't worked. Like I've tried the eliminate social media apps on my phone. Well, I can still log into the browser. I've gone through and I've gotten rid of all my junk emails and I've unsubscribed from so many emails, but I still check my phone. Like, well, maybe there's something. And I've tried many of these hacks that you talk about, and they haven't worked. Why haven't they been able to work?
Yeah, so I'm not a psychologist, but within the psychology world, what we're all trying is harm reduction. We're trying to figure out various shortcuts. And look, we're all into shortcuts. We're all into YouTube videos. If we can figure out a 2-minute YouTube video that can teach us the science to losing all weight and having a healthy diet, then let's find that 2-minute video. But the truth is, when it comes to smartphone, which is really a behavioral addiction, what it has become, just as you expressed, shortcuts just aren't going to cut it. So digital Sabbath, incredibly noble to have your phone off for 24 hours a day. So many people are doing it. I think it's great that people are doing it. But if you tell someone who's addicted to cigarettes to stop smoking for 24 hours each week, they're just gonna be back to smoking cigarettes the other 6 days. So too, in terms of a digital Sabbath, yeah, in terms of social media, like you said, there's so many other addictive aspects of the phone. Turning your phone to grayscale, turning it on airplane mode, phone foyer method. I've talked to dozens of people and who've tried so many of these different things, and it just doesn't work in terms of being able to be in control of the phone. And really, the leading culprit for it all really is dopamine. I mean, the brain releases dopamine each time you check it. There's this great anticipation in terms of, what's going to be appearing, what's going to ding, what am I going to see? There's this unpredictability element, and your brain craves it. You want to be able to check it wherever you are, whether you're at the grocery store or you're at home. So, yeah, that's where that's all coming from. And yeah, that's why hacks just don't cut it.
Okay, hacks don't cut it. But what does cut it are some of the suggestions in your book. And you have this thing called off by default. What is that? Like your phone just switches off unless you do something?
So, off by default is one of the four strategies or breakup styles I recommend in the book for turning your phone off. So, basically, what I prescribe in the book is going to be incredibly difficult and incredibly challenging, but absolutely necessary, especially when you're going through a big life change like removing a smartphone from your environment. I'm not going to make the argument that you should never have a smartphone. In fact, for many people for work, I interviewed an anesthesiologist at one of the top research hospitals in the country. A smartphone is absolutely required for work. So I'm never going to make the argument to never not have a smartphone. But for 60 days, I recommend turning it off. And there are four different strategies I outline in the book on how you can do that in terms of turning a smartphone off. And one of those approaches is the one that I embrace, which is the off by default approach. So for the 60-day detox where you turn your phone off, the off by default approach is that your smartphone remains off. You're not going to throw it away. You're not going to get rid of it. You're not going to switch to a basic phone. You are going to hold on to it, but you are not going to turn it on for 60 days unless something critical comes up. Now, what would critical mean? Critical would mean, okay, you get into a car accident, God forbid, but you get into a car accident and you are just stuck and you need to call AAA or whatever it might be. You need to call your spouse or a sibling to let them know what happened. All right, you turn your smartphone on in that instance, you make the call, and then you turn it back off after you're done with that. So that would be defined as a critical task. Now, what would not be defined as a critical task? You go to a music concert and you're waiting for the act to come on because you got to the show 30 minutes early. Don't turn it on. Like, all right, just be okay with being in the theater or at the concert for 30 minutes and not turning on your phone. So only turn it on for critical tasks. And for the people who I interviewed, as well as myself, who embraced this approach for 60 days, at least 60 days, they never turned it on. We think that there are emergencies in life in terms of like critical tasks. Yeah, I turned mine off for an entire year, but thank goodness there were no emergencies, so I didn't turn it on for the year. But it works because there's a certain comfort, especially if you're going out with kids or grandkids or whatever it might be to the zoo. You're going through this detox. You have the smartphone in the bag. So let's say you're taking your grandkids out to the zoo. You know, your kids might be like, hey, I don't feel comfortable with you not having a smartphone or any sort of phone in case there's an emergency. You can at least tell them, I have it. It's in the bag. And if there's an emergency, I'll use it. But in real life, there really aren't that many actual emergencies. So that's the off by default approach. After the 60 days are complete, you can actually still embrace the off by default approach, which is what I do. But you can change the definition of the philosophy slightly. So instead of only turning on the phone for critical tasks, you can change it to only turn on the phone when you want to do something that will enhance your life. That way, for example, like my phone right now is off. It's in another room. Actually, I'm not sure where it is right now. But the only time I turn it on is for something that will enhance my life.
Enhance your life. Well, that is very subjective, isn't it? Because a lot of people would say, oh, social media enhances my life. But if we all really think about it, social media basically does nothing for any of us. And this is one of the other suggestions you make is simplifying your phone. So I don't like social media anyway, but I took it off my phone a long time ago. And then I took off one of my email accounts and I took off my work email account versus my personal account. I don't know if I should have done it the other way around, but it is interesting to observe how my habits are throughout the day since I don't have my work email on my phone. Is that how you would simplify, or how do you suggest simplifying?
Yeah, so that's fantastic in terms of you getting work email off your phone. But I would consider that to be sort of like one of the shortcuts in terms of like spending less time on it. Simplify your phone, at least in how I define it. So four breakup strategies in the book, different ways to turn off your phone. We mentioned the off by default. The next one we can talk about is simplifying your phone, which is that you basically go to a basic phone. By basic phone, it also could be dumb phone, it could be brick phone, flip phone, whatever you want to call it. And it was interesting because I was actually looking at Google Trends the other week because I wanted to see where people in the country are searching for basic phones the most. And Utah is the state that where people are searching for basic phones the most. I thought that was incredible and how fitting for this conversation. So there are many, many basic phones out there. I mean, there are dozens and dozens of different models that are supported by major networks like AT&T and Verizon. Some that are more expensive, some that are less expensive. For the sake of the 60 days, what I recommend is going as basic as possible. So we're talking like an Alcatel flip phone, a TCL flip, a Nokia. I mean, something that has, you know, the T9 texting interface where you literally, if you remember back in the day, this is 20 years ago, you hit the 9 three times, then the 5 three times to try and send a text message. I mean, it gets so irritating that you don't want to do it. And that's like the point. The point is like, you don't want to spend all that time on it. So for the 60 days, I recommend going as basic as you possibly can. And you can go two ways of doing it. One is you can switch the SIM card over from your existing smartphone to the basic phone. So keep all your contacts. I think it might be the easiest way of doing it. Or if you really, really want to challenge yourself, which is what some people did that I profile and interview for the book, you can really go cold turkey and start from scratch. I preface this by saying I have a whole section in the book about preparation. It's really important to prepare for this detox. You don't want to detox too quickly. So I go through a whole preparation and evaluation period in terms of the book before going through a detox like this. But I think this is the easiest transition if you're going to turn your phone off for 60 days is to go to a basic phone. And it's really interesting. Almost everyone I interviewed for the book went through their detox in terms of switching to a basic phone. And almost everyone stuck with a basic phone that I interviewed. But what they ended up doing was they went with a basic phone that had a little more functionality. So there's certain popular basic phones like the Lite phone. That's a very popular one. The Modita Compact, the Kyocera Dura Extreme. These are some of the more popular Lite phones that are basic phones that are a little more expensive, but they have a little more functionality than the most basic of basic.
Well, Richard, let's talk about learning to live without GPS, because I am a huge fan of maps. I'm going on a trip and I already have maps printed, even on 11 by 17 for different sections of the trip in this other country, because I don't want to have to count on my phone to show me where I'm going in case there's no service. And I just like having that spatial awareness and understanding where I am. How has GPS so really messed up humanity's ability to navigate?
That's so interesting. GPS is something that came up very often in my interviews and something that I experienced. I was really scared the first one or two times, like I drove without GPS when I was going through my detox. It was very scary. But then I learned, like, and remembered from when I first started to drive, I was a teen at the time. I mean, just how empowering it is in terms of not having to engage with a GPS. It really is just wonderful being able to engage with printed out directions and actually paper maps. So there's someone I profile in the book who's an attorney who lives in Spain, and she moved from the East Coast to Spain. And you figure that, okay, like she's in this new place, like GPS would be something that would be wonderful. But for her, like she had a basic phone. She wanted to engage with the space with real paper maps. And she found that she said she was horrible at directions before. And all of a sudden she said, I'm using these paper maps and like I'm really engaging with my new home. I'm engaging with this new place. I also interviewed a software engineer who's in Seattle who was on a business trip in Europe who didn't have GPS because he was on a basic phone. And he said it was so charming to ask people on the actual street, hey, how do you get here? How do I walk to this place? Asking the concierge of the hotel, hey, how do I go about doing this? It can be very daunting. It can be very scary at first, but especially in the context of detox, as you're going through this process of getting away from your smartphone, it really can be a very empowering process in terms of engaging with a location. Another couple I interviewed that's based in Italy, they switched to basic phones as a part of their detox together in terms of quitting together. That's one of the other breakup styles in the book that I outline is quitting together as a unit. And the two of them did it together, a couple in Italy, and they went on a train to a new place and they didn't have GPS technology. And they said they enjoyed the trip so much more because they didn't have it, because they felt like they were just exploring a new place without having to be guided constantly by this voice that was taking them everywhere. They could really guide themselves. So yeah, in the context of detox, it's actually something not to be afraid of. It's something to really celebrate.
So, in addition to learning how to read a paper map, what else can people do to prepare to even just do a mini detox?
Yeah, so I have a number of quick tips in the book to help ease your way into getting away from being so smartphone dependent. And one of them is to optimize your home environment, especially if you remove a smartphone from your life. You're going to crave high dopamine replacement activities. That's going to include television. That's going to include your computer. That's what it was for me, was my computer. And that was like my crutch. And the important thing is to resist that as much as you can. And a good way of doing it is basically to set up one space in the house for those high dopamine replacement activities. So, for example, TV, computer, video game system, put them in, let's say, the basement, or put them in the workroom, or whatever it might be. And make sure that the kitchen is the place where you eat. Make it so that the living room is a place that you engage with your family. Make it so the bedroom is a place that you sleep. Make sure those things don't come into other areas of the house because your brain is going to crave those things. Now, what if you're someone who's listening who lives in an apartment? I have a creative solution there, which is I interviewed someone for the book who created a tent in their apartment. So the tent was the space where deep work was done. The tent was a space where engaging with your partner was done, where it gets away from screens. You know, if you're in a one-bedroom apartment or if you're in a studio, it can be quite challenging to get screens away from your space. Well, create a tent where it's your deep workspace. It's your space to not engage with other high dopamine replacement activities.
Okay, if we are convinced that we are not the person that responds to a dopamine rush, and someone who's listening to this thinking, this is not really me, I would love for you to tell us. I mean, we know like that there's a big concern about us using GPS because we're going to lose this really important function in our brain that orients us to the world, especially north, south, east, and west. And as it turns out, actually following the signs, the road signs, is a really good practice. And it's not just fun, it actually works. But I'm wondering about other things in the brain. You know, we've talked a little bit about creativity and deepening relationships. Can you mention a couple of others?
Non-screen activities, I think, are a real biggie. That was one thing that I found from so many of my interviews was that we've built, which isn't a terrible thing, but we've built so many habits that are screen dependent, whether it be social media or whether it be ways of connection digitally. It's so important to get away from screens for hobbies. So going for walks without a phone, or hikes without a phone, going to a restaurant, engaging with friends and leaving your phone at home, doing different sports and getting away from a screen. I interview someone who gardens with her family where screens are never in the mix. I interviewed a beekeeper who the phone never comes into the mix. So, I think it's really, really important to have those non-screen activities because at least with, I'm a millennial. So many of us, when we get home after our work day, so many of us are spending anywhere from 3 to 5 hours just on our phones or in front of a screen. It's really, really important to get away from that, to read, to go for walks, to go for hikes. Yeah, don't bring a phone with you on walks. Don't bring a phone with you on hikes. Don't bring a phone with you to a restaurant when you're with a friend. It's okay for an hour to not be on call and to be at a restaurant and just to enjoy someone else's company.
Well, our guest today has been Richard Simon. He is the author of the book Unplug: How to Break Up with Your Phone and Reclaim Your Life. Richard, thank you for being the guinea pig for all of us and sharing these important tools. I know that I'm going to be looking at my phone differently, or maybe not looking at it at all.
Katie, Lynn, thank you so much for having me. Really appreciate it. It's great to be on.
Welcome back to Cool Science Radio. I'm Katie Mullally.
And I'm Lynn Ware Peak.
Most of us assume that spring runoff makes it directly to our water sources, like rivers and reservoirs. However, new research from the University of Utah hydrologists suggests that this stream flow is much more complicated. They have found that most spring runoff heading to our reservoirs is actually several years old, indicating that most mountain snowfall has a years-long invisible journey as groundwater before it leaves the mountains. Here to tell us more about this study and our water's trajectory is Paul Brooks, a professor of geology and geophysics at the U. Paul, welcome to Cool Science Radio.
Thank you for having me. Pleasure to be here.
Like I said in the intro, we all just assume that our spring runoff just goes right into the rivers, but tell us about all these many pathways our runoff take.
So that's a great question. It seems so intuitive, right? That it gets warm in the spring and warm melts the snow and the snow runs off. We see the streams respond almost immediately. It seems very, very intuitive. But it turns out that it's much more complicated than that, both in terms of what's driving snow melt and then where that snow melt actually goes. And I think because it seems so familiar to us, especially those of us who live in the West, we kind of take for granted that we understand that it gets warm, that the warmth melts the snow and the snow runs into the stream. We now know, or we've been learning over the last couple decades, that it's more and more complicated. What this particular study shows, it's for the first time we've been able to document how many years it actually takes a particular water molecule to move from a snowflake in the snowpack and actually make it to the stream. And it turns out that throughout the Western US, it's 5.5 years. I mean, that was even a little bit surprising to us,
Well, let's talk about the pathways because again, snow melts, goes down the mountainside into the rivers. But if it's spending 5.5 years underground, I'm assuming this isn't just what we typically think of as groundwater that's subsurface down below the flat areas. Where is it lurking?
Yeah, exactly. Can you tell us? That's what we really want to know. So some of the snow melt actually just runs down the hillside and into the streams. But it turns out most of the snow melt actually infiltrates in the soils. And we've heard in the past that when soils are dry, they soak up a lot of water, right? And so you can sort of think of the soils as a sponge. What this work shows is that it's not just that soil sponge, that somewhere underneath, there's something called saprolite, there's fractured bedrock, there's many, many storage pockets and storage areas in the subsurface that can hold on to water. And most of the snow melt goes into that subsurface water storage. And so when it's sitting in that subsurface water storage, it's there for years. And plants can access it through tree roots, some of it, not all of it, and some of it drains off to the stream. And so this idea that it takes multiple years for a water molecule to make it to the stream really changes the way we think about drought. It changes the way we think about stream flow prediction each year. And it changes the way we think about forest growth and forest susceptibility to insects. As there's much, much more water. Rather than a shallow saucer with a sponge on top holding a little bit of water in soils, it's much more like a big, deep bucket with a sponge on top. Does that make sense?
It does make sense. It's so interesting, and it sort of answers a couple of questions that we all hear each year, like after, you know, one of the biggest years of snowfall 2 years ago that we had here in Utah, there's still talk of drought. And, you know, we know, I guess pragmatically, you can say that 1 year of a huge volume of snowfall, it's not going to zero out the drought. It may have some impact on it. But is this part of, you know, what you're now finding out is that the reason is that snow that fell 2 years ago is not going to be really surfacing necessarily for 5 years?
So what we've found is indeed closely related to this idea of drought, this concept of drought. The way we predict and relate drought is usually, you know, how warm it is, how dry the air is, and how much precipitation we've had over a relatively short period of time. And so 2023 was a fantastic water year. It didn't result in great flooding. It was even bigger than the years in the mid-1980s, but we didn't have that big flooding. And part of the reason we didn't have that big flooding is so much of that water that was in the snowpack went in and filled up the groundwater stores. So in related work, we've been monitoring mountain groundwater storage for a number of years now. One of the amazing things about Utah is that we keep really good records here. We have unprecedented climate and stream flow data going back 125 years. And that's allowed us to quantify changes in this groundwater storage over time. And what we found was that in 2021 and 2022, when the Great Salt Lake reached its minimum level, and if you remember, 2022 was about an average snow year. It was kind of like this year. Some areas were a bit below, some areas were a bit below, above in snowpack. On average, it was maybe 95%. But we had horrible stream flow runoff. And the reason we had horrible stream flow runoff, any stream flow runoff is great, but it wasn't as much as we were hoping for, as water managers were hoping for, based on the amount of snow. And a big part of that reason was that groundwater storage was at a record low level. And when the groundwater storage was at a record low level, that snow melt filled up that empty bucket. And so that's where the melt goes first. It goes first into the bucket and then spills out of the bucket into the streams. And when the bucket's empty, we have really poor stream flow. And so we saw that in 2022, which was a near record low stream flow. 2023, that water in 2022 helped to fill up the groundwater a little bit. But it takes years to fill up that groundwater storage in the mountains. And so 2023, the groundwater storage was still low. And that snowmelt wasn't able to push out water to the stream.
Let me just ask you a question. It so flies in the face of what we know, or what we were told about the spring runoff in 2023. And by the way, let me reintroduce you. We're speaking with Paul Brooks. He's in the Department of Geology and Geophysics at the University of Utah. And we're talking to him about how the West's spring runoff is older than you think. Okay, so in 2023, the big year, the year that we thought we'd have just incredible flooding and then we didn't, we were all told that it was because, you know, we didn't have really fast warming temperatures, really extreme warming temperatures that accelerated the spring runoff. But what you're telling me is that there was this empty bucket. And really where a lot of that runoff went was into that bucket from previous years. And so then it makes me ask the question, okay, back in, let's go back to 1982, 83. What was the year where they were kayaking on State Street because there was such a huge flood? Was that 82 or?
No.
84, I don't remember.
So there were a series of wet years. And in my mind, I think it's 84.
Oh, 84. Okay, that makes sense. Yeah, 84.
I'm not 100% certain on that. I wasn't here then.
And then that could tell the story, I suppose, about those years. There were several years that were really big. And so the bucket was full. And that's how we got the flooding in Salt Lake? Or did it have something else to do with, you know, some of these reasons we've traditionally believed?
Yeah. So these are fantastic questions. And I want to try to think about where's the most productive way to dive in. And so I'd be remiss in conveying information from my colleagues and partners in Salt Lake City Public Utilities. Part of the reason for the flooding was drainage that was blocked and the infrastructure wasn't ready to handle it. And so that was a big part. But if you take that part out, if you look all across Utah and across the Western U.S., we had a series of relatively wet years, roughly from 82 to 87, I think. 83, 84, in that area, there was some pretty good wet years. But there was a series of wet years. And when we go back and we look at our historical records, we can see that the mountain groundwater was at its highest level that we have records for. And so there wasn't anywhere for that water to go. So much of it went into the Great Salt Lake, and that was the record high. If you go to the Colorado River Basin, there was concern about the dams failing. But those years were amazing. You know, the fastest record in travel through the Grand Canyon, reservoirs were full everywhere. But it was a series of wet years that had filled up the groundwater storage. And we've seen that. It's about 12 to 15 years throughout much of the West. We go through these high and these low stages of groundwater storage. We get a series of wet years and we fill up groundwater and we get more and more efficient stream flow generation. Going back to what you were told or what we were told about fast melt versus slow melt, that's absolutely true. That's absolutely correct. You can think of a year where we get little snowfalls regularly. Like Soyper wasn't a great year this year, right? But if we'd had little snowfalls like we just had recently, it refreshes the mountain snowpack. It reflects the sunlight, and the sunlight is what really melts the snow. It's not so much the temperature. It's mostly the incoming radiation. And so you get little bits of sunlight, little bits of snow, little bits of snow that reflects the sunlight. And so the snowpack stays intact or it melts very, very slowly for a while. And then eventually you don't get any more snow. The sun is high in the sky and the snow melts really quickly. That's a very, very quick, efficient way to generate stream flow. And part of that is because it melts so fast that it can't work its way to groundwater as efficiently. You know, if it melts more slowly, when you think of soil and groundwater physics, that should allow water to move a little bit more deeply into the ground. The other thing that happens is the snowpack is sitting out there for a long period of time while it's melting. And if it's sitting out there for a long period of time while it's melting, it's evaporating and sublimating. And so you can think of it as a tax. So you have X amount of water in the snowpack, and then the atmosphere extracts a tax through melt or through evaporation and sublimation. And then after you pay that atmospheric tax, whatever water you have left, that net snow water equivalent can go into soils, can go into groundwater and go into the stream. But those are really the only three options for it. And so when it melts slowly, more of that snowpack goes to the atmosphere as a tax. It evaporates and less of it makes it into the ground.
Paul, let's talk about how you measured these hydrogen molecules. You used, now I hope I say this right, tritium isotope analysis. What is that? And did I say it right?
Oh, it's tritium.
Tritium. Okay, tritium isotope analysis.
So I like tritium, though. It sounds good. I might start using that. Tritium is naturally produced. The tritium that we measure is naturally produced. So up in the upper atmosphere. And incoming cosmic rays, incoming neutrons, interact with nitrogen, and it turns the nitrogen, it splits the nitrogen into two molecules, one tritium and one carbon. So that tritium that's naturally produced in the atmosphere interacts with all the water molecules in the atmosphere, the water vapor, and is incorporated into those water molecules. But tritium is radioactive, and it takes 12.3 years as a half-life. So if you start with 100 units and 12.3 years later, you would have 50 units left. And that's a very regular decay rate. And that decay rate lets us calculate the age of water, how long it's been since a water molecule fell from the sky, which has the natural background tritium content to it. And then that slowly decays over time. And how much you have left is a clock. It's essentially a clock.
In the article, I think it was in Nature, you were talking about how tritium is also formed from nuclear reactors going online. So can you do you constantly measure the levels of tritium in the current atmosphere so that, let's say, 5 years from now, you will know? Or is that pretty much a constant and you're only looking at the decay rate?
So you guys are asking such great questions. So there has been a long-term effort around the globe to track tritium in the atmosphere because of all the nuclear testing in the 1960s introduced huge amounts of tritium. Just ridiculous, many, many orders of magnitude more. And actually, some of the first places that tritium was used as a tracer was in the oceans, and that was, it's called the bomb spike. So monitoring tritium in precipitation and then monitoring it in oceans and large lakes were some of the first areas where tritium was used to get an idea of how deep and surface waters interact in the ocean and in very, very large lakes. So that bomb testing, we outlawed above ground bomb tests. We've seen a decay, and starting in about the year 2000, we've seen a relatively steady background level that's produced naturally in the atmosphere. And there's a peak in production in the spring, and then there's different rates of deposition or amounts of deposition of tritium the further away you get from the coast. And those patterns are reasonably well established, but they're part of ongoing monitoring efforts by both U.S., hopefully we'll continue to do that, and international agencies that have given us a pretty good idea of what background concentrations are. One of the areas that we're working right now, and there's students at the University of Utah who are focused on this. Some of my colleagues at the USGS in Colorado are focused on this, trying to understand the local scale variability. Does the tritium here in the Wasatch, is it different than what falls in the Uintas or the San Juans in Colorado, for example? How much does it vary over the course of the season? Those are the sort of questions where we're trying to fine tune our numbers for the tritium input. Those changes will only change the findings from this study a little bit. It could be incredibly important for things like pollutants or calculating a site-specific, a particular watershed or catchment that you might be interested in managing or predicting how it will respond to drought. But fine-tuning those inputs gives us an idea of better spatial and temporal resolution of what happens to that water once it's in the ground. That's the part that really excites me. I'm an accidental hydrologist. It's like water is just, every time I started looking at a question or an issue, understanding water became integral to finding the answer, whether it was pollution, climate change, tree growth, carbon cycling, carbon storage, exposure to pollutants, degradation of, you know, understanding the water, where it came from and where it was going was critical. And so now pretty much all I do is water. But knowing that there's a large amount of water in the ground and it's there for years means we need these finer resolution measurements to figure out how much is really being used by plants. Where are these trees more likely to survive? Or if you want to replant after a fire or insects or disturbance, knowing that some places have greater storage and perhaps a little bit more buffered to one or two dry years, and other places less can help us make decisions about that. So those site-specific details, it's not just for streamflow prediction. It's for thinking about our mountain environments. I'm kind of a fan of mountain environments. I like them a lot. And yeah. And understanding how they work, how they're plumbed, is what I spend most of my time on right now.
Yeah.
And so these finer resolution measurements of tritium will help us disentangle those two questions of how much of that water is just sort of stored there, slowly making its way to the stream, how much of it can be pushed out each year quickly with snowmelt, and how much is there to support wetlands or to support trees, to support mountain vegetation. Those questions are all intertwined, and it's a very, very different way of looking at water in the mountains than we've had in the past.
So, Paul, I'm wondering how land use sort of messes up your study. And the land use that I'm speaking of in particular is the one that this little mountain town is built on top of, which is lots of mine tunnels, miles and miles and miles of silver mining tunnels. And, you know, we get our drinking water from the abandoned mine tunnels. Obviously, the more porous the ground, the more holes there are in the ground, the older the water is. How does mining affect how old that water is when it comes out? And then how are those waters sort of diluted by the snowmelt as it comes through the porous?
You guys are so good. You are asking all the questions that will fire a caffeinated Paul up to just keep talking and talking and talking. So it's a great question. And it's actually how I started on this question, this issue of where water is in the mountains and where it's going. Last century, the end of last century, when I was a postdoc, I was actually working on these questions. Abandoned mines in Colorado and the heavy metals that they were leaching out to water systems. And that's really where I saw the first hints that snowmelt wasn't just simply running off the surface and interacting with mine tailings and taking heavy metals into streams that way. That happens, that definitely happens. But there were places where mine tailings had been cleaned up and we had all these mine adits, the old mine tunnels, and they were filling up and spilling out heavy metals at all. And it was like, wow, it's taking a lot longer for this water to get out than we thought it was. And when we tried to trace the snow melt, it wasn't going right into the stream. It was going into the mine, it going into the subsurface and eventually into the mine tunnels. And so that was I was a biochemist and toxicologist in my mind at that point. I was interested in human health and exposure, but we figured out we needed to get the water right. And while we're making progress on that, we don't have it solved. We do know that it's going to vary based on the geology. A lot of mines are in hard rock systems where they're valuable metals. And the study shows that those systems have less storage and respond very, very differently than systems that are more, you can think of it as a bunch of broken rock or sedimentary systems or carfs, underground caves, areas that have much more storage underground, respond very differently. But those are not subject to as much mining as a lot of the hard rock sites. And so from this work, it shows that the storage is a bit less. And the mine tunnels, the old mine adits, probably play a pretty important role in changing the amount of storage and in creating preferential flow paths. And so it gives you an idea of, rather than water moving all over the subsurface, we kind of have these preferential channels. We think that's true in most subsurface systems, that there are preferential areas where the water moves a little bit more efficiently. But the mine tunnels and the mine adits clearly foster that more direct movement of water. And by doing that, it gives us hope that we can intercept that water. Again, it's challenging. There are thousands of mines in the West, and any sort of remediation of this mine waste requires large investments, and it requires someone to follow them in perpetuity.
Paul, it's amazing how important this subsurface water is, and not just groundwater, but the water that we've been talking about. And I'm assuming that the melt rate really has an impact on how the subsurface is refilled. But we were talking with Mackenzie Skiles the other day from the Hydro Lab about the effects of dust on that melt rate. So as snowmelt is melting faster, will that have a negative impact on this storage unit of water, if you will?
So that's a great question. Mackenzie is doing some fantastic stuff. The two components of this are how quickly the snow melts, and that determines where it goes, and it reduces the amount that's lost to the atmosphere. And then does it recharge groundwater, or does it go into the streams preferentially? Our conceptual models, our operational models, suggest that if it melts, our soil physics models, our models based on soil physics, suggest that if it melts more quickly, it's less likely to infiltrate the ground, but more likely to make it to the stream. Now, just in the last several years, what they found is that when the snow melts more quickly, it more efficiently recharges that groundwater. And that's pretty much everywhere we've looked. And so at first that had us scratching our heads until we went back to the idea that, well, when the snowpack is sitting there at the surface, that when it melts quickly, less of that water evaporates. So there's more to go to both the stream and more to go to groundwater. That's a change. And so that's one of the reasons why we're excited to work together. This idea of, wow, there's a lot of storage. But if storage increases when it melts more quickly, and stream flow increases when it melts more quickly, that the only other place for the water to go is to the sky.
Well, our guest today has been Professor Paul Brooks. He is with the Geology and Geophysics Department at the U and head of a study that has determined the age of our snowmelt, and it's a lot older than they thought. Paul, thank you so much for joining us on Cool Science Radio.
Thank you very much. It was a pleasure to be here.
Thanks for tuning into Cool Science Radio here on KPCW. You can find this episode on kpcw.org under the Shows tab, on the KPCW app, or wherever you get your podcasts at KPCW Cool Science Radio.
And if you liked today's episode, rate us, subscribe to the show, and share it with your friends.